Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. Today's guest, Nathan Thrall, just won a Pulitzer Prize for his latest book, A Day in the Life of Abed Salama, Anatomy of a Jerusalem Tragedy. The book tells the story of a 2012 bus accident on the outskirts of East Jerusalem, in which six Palestinian kindergartners and a teacher burned to death. The book details how Israel's occupation has shaped every aspect of the tragedy. Nathan Thrall says the aim of the book is to give readers a visceral sense of what it is like to live in Israel and Palestine and to explore Israel's system of control over Palestinians. In addition to the Pulitzer Prize, A Day in the Life of Abed Salama was named Best Book of the Year by many major media publications, including The New Yorker, The Economist, Time, and The New Republic. A Day in the Life of Abed Salama was published on October 3rd, just 4 days before the deadly Hamas attacks in Israel. In the wake of the attacks and the Israeli military's assault on Gaza, several of Nathan Thrall's book events have been canceled or postponed in cities like Frankfurt, London, New York, Washington, D.C., and Los Angeles. In 2017, Nathan Thrall wrote his first book of essays called The Only Language They Understand, Forcing Compromise in Israel and Palestine. His essays, reviews, and features on Israel and Palestine have appeared in the New York Times Magazine, The Guardian, and the London Review of Books. He has spent a decade at the International Crisis Group, where he was director of the Arab-Israeli Project, and he's lived in Jerusalem for 13 years. Hi, Nathan. Congratulations on winning the Pulitzer, and thank you so much for joining us again.
Thank you, Rose. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Well, it's great to have you back, Nathan. So much has changed since we last spoke. Let's first talk about the latest in Gaza. The AP is reporting that the Israeli military confirmed that its forces are now in central parts of Rafah. Philippe Lazzarini, Commissioner General of UNRWA, tweeted, "People are searching for safety to no avail. It's an endless horror show, except it's real. 2 million people are living in a hellhole." According to the death count right now, it's 36,000 Palestinians killed, 81,000 wounded, over 1 million have forced to flee. I mean, we could go on and on. The situation is just so catastrophic. What do you make of the latest in Gaza?
Well, the most disturbing aspect of all of this is that we really do not see any end in sight. There appears to be an intention by the Israeli government to continue this war for the coming months and possibly years. And without any kind of realistic hope of leaving Gaza and leaving Gaza in a position to rebuild itself.
To that point, Israel's national security advisor said the assault on Gaza will likely continue through at least the end of the year. So many people have been wondering, how long can this last? So what are your thoughts on this, Nathan? I mean, what is Israel's end game?
So there's a widespread view in Israel and within the Israeli government that the war is actually going pretty well, that Israel is steadily making gains against Hamas, that it is greatly degrading Hamas's forces. It now has established a corridor in Gaza that splits the north from the south. There may be plans to establish more corridors in Gaza. Prior to 2005, there were settlements in Gaza, just as there are settlements in the West Bank. And the goal of those settlements, as in the West Bank, is to fragment the Palestinian population centers in order to prevent any possibility of a Palestinian state emerging. And similarly, now in Gaza, whether there are settlements or not is a separate question, but there can be Israeli fingers that extend across Gaza and split it into fragments. And then the Israeli policy would be much like it is in the West Bank today, which is to go in and do raids and then come back to these corridors that they control, or in the case of the West Bank, bases and settlements. And that to many Israelis appears to be an achievable, goal. And, you know, so far there has been very little in terms of accountability, for over a half century of occupation. There's been a lot of finger wagging from the world. And, so long as the costs are perceived as to be relatively low, this is a path that Israel thinks it can pursue for quite a long time.
So you mentioned the response from the outside world. What do you make of how President Biden is responding to this? U.S.-made munitions were used in the horrific strike on a tent camp in Rafah. According to CNN, that horrific strike killed 45 Palestinians. The Washington Post reports that the White House says Israel has not violated Biden's warnings, suggesting that the U.S. would impose no consequences for the strike. So overall, what do you think about what's happening with President Biden and his administration?
Well, the administration has made itself fully complicit in this war, in Israel's actions, and it is U.S. bombs, U.S. munitions that are being used, in President Biden's own words, indiscriminately against the Palestinian population of Gaza. And there is absolutely no excuse for it. And the Biden administration, the only real consideration for it is U.S. public opinion, whether there is some chance that Biden could potentially lose this coming election over U.S. American outrage over his support for this war. And really, that's the one thing that has pushed him to issue statements, or to for the administration to leak to the press that they had a so-called tough conversation with the Israelis. But in actual substance, Israel has the U.S.'s full backing. That's all they care about. And a few you know, critical words in public mean very, very little. Mm.
What do we need to know about what is happening in Israel? The AP reports that mothers of Israeli soldiers fighting in Gaza protested on Wednesday, calling for an end to the fighting. They blocked roads. They shouted anti-government slogans. They covered their bodies in blood, blood red paint, symbolizing the bloodshed. And then protesters have been taking to the streets to demand the resignation of Netanyahu and a return of hostages. I mean, how big are these movements? What do we need to know in the U.S. about what's happening in Israel?
So far, the protests against the government have been rather small. There has been constant speculation that they will grow in size. There was a time during the first months of the war when everyone in Israel said, as soon as the reservists come back home, they will join the protests, and then they will balloon and reach the size of the protests that had occurred for the year prior to this war against this government. And that has not occurred yet. And the thing that should be remembered is even those protests, these massive protests against the government, against a legislative reform that the government wanted to put through, a so-called judicial reform, that many secular Israelis viewed as a step toward theocracy in Israel and an undermining of the judiciary. Those protests were quite large. They did not have the Palestinian issue at the forefront of them, even really at the periphery. It was a tiny presence. And those protests, despite their size, did not bring the government down. And so we are very far from seeing protests that have the ability to bring this government down, even if the centrist members of the coalition who joined during the war, Benny Gantz and Gadi Eisenkot, even if they were to leave, the coalition still is stable and strong. And the other thing that should be said is that even if we have elections in Israel and Netanyahu were to be replaced, the people who are likely to replace him really do not have a different vision for the prosecution of this war and for the policy toward the Palestinians in general. There is a consensus in that centrist camp around indefinite control over Palestinian lives.
We're speaking with Nathan Thrall, who just won a Pulitzer Prize for his new book, A Day in the Life of Abed Salama, Anatomy of a Jerusalem Tragedy. Nathan, before we talk more about your book, can you tell us a bit about your background and how you got to this place? How are your views shaped? I read a piece about you in The Guardian called It's Lonely Being a Jewish Critic of Israel. And you talked about how your mom has a tribal attachment to Israel and cannot bear to read anything you write. So can you tell us more about that and just how you got to this place?
You know, I grew up, and my mom's side of the family are Soviet immigrants. And they came to the U.S. a few years before I was born, and they have a strong attachment to Israel, like many Soviet immigrants. But I have to say that it wasn't really a large part of my awareness growing up. And it was only after I traveled to Israel for the first time in my 20s that I started to have a curiosity about what this place was. And it was really just years after that that I began to read about the history here and open my eyes to this system of oppression that has lasted for more than half a century, that I was entirely blind to, including on those early trips to Israel where I came here and, like many tourists, had virtually no awareness of the existence of the system of control.
And so given the work that you do, I mean, you say that this book, you want this book to give people a sense of what it's like to live in Israel and Palestine and to explore Israel's system of control over Palestinians. I mean, what has this experience been like with family members, with friends in Israel who, you know, have very different opinions about your work and about what is happening?
Well, you learn to, find a small circle of people who think similarly to you, and you have a close sense of community with those people. And you have to learn to live in a society that you are fundamentally at odds with. And that's just the nature of being in this place. I mean, you know, public opinion polls here show that the vast majority of Israelis think that either the right amount of force has been used in Gaza or that more force needs to be used in Gaza. So that's the environment that I live in. And fortunately, I do have close Palestinian and Israeli friends who see the world as I do and are trying, they're fighting a losing battle, but they're trying to change things.
What reaction have you received on the road? In the intro, I talked about how several of your book talks have been canceled or postponed in places like London, Los Angeles, just recently in Frankfurt. I mean, you're on the road around the globe talking to people about what it is like to live under occupation. And we're going to talk about that, what it's like to have certain ID cards, what it's like when you can't drive on a certain road. These are very basic things that a lot of people don't know unless they're either connected to Israel-Palestine or they've been interested and read. What sort of response have you received by sharing this information, especially with people who are interested in this, care about this issue, but might not know the ins and outs?
Despite those cancellations that occurred after October 7th, The events that I did have were overwhelmingly positive. People were hungry for this information. They were grateful for it. I assume that the people who are really angered by a conversation about Palestinian life under occupation are just not attending my events. And so I feel like the book has really been embraced by people who would like to know what the reality is here. And part of the motivation for writing it was that I saw how powerful an experience it was for Americans to come on trips here. Often it was congressional staff or members of Congress whom I would sometimes meet on those trips. And they would, you know, spend the vast majority of their time in Israel, but they would allot one day or half a day to going into the West Bank. And that day or half day was the most important part of their trip, and it stuck with them because what they saw was, you know, unequivocally a system of ethnic domination that reminded them of Jim Crow, that reminded them of apartheid in South Africa. And they really had no idea how oppressive it was, how systematic it was. And most Americans, I think, would be horrified if they actually saw it with their own eyes and learned the degree to which they are supporting it. All of us as Americans are supporting it, whether we like it or not. And so what I wanted to do was to write something that would really put people in the shoes of Palestinians living under occupation. Also, there are Jewish characters in the book, and to show their perspectives as well. There are settler characters in the book, and to show their perspectives as well. And to really give the reader a visceral sense of what it is to actually live in this system. And hopefully, by giving that visceral sense, also giving them a sense of what a moral catastrophe it is.
Well, if you have a question or comment for Nathan Thrall, who just won a Pulitzer for his new book, A Day in the Life of Abed Salama, Anatomy of a Jerusalem Tragedy, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. So as you say, you want to give readers a sense of what it's like to live in Israel and Palestine and to explore Israel's system of control over Palestinians. And you do this by telling the story of a tragic 2012 bus accident on the outskirts of East Jerusalem, in which six Palestinian kindergartners and a teacher burned to death. Can you remind us, when did you hear about this? And then why did you decide to spend so much time working on this to figure out what exactly happened?
So the environment that I live in Jerusalem and also in the West Bank is a highly, highly segregated one. And you have Palestinians living in small enclaves right up against Jewish-Israeli settlements that are often built on the lands of those same Palestinian villages next door, lands that have been confiscated from those villages. And these communities have virtually zero interaction with one another. And to really tell the story of Israel-Palestine, I wanted to tell a story of a moment in which these two communities did interact with one another, something like a car accident. And the particular location where this occurred, you know, the kindergartners on this bus, they all live in a walled enclave. That's just a couple miles from my house in Jerusalem. And they are surrounded on three sides by a 26-foot-tall concrete wall, on a fourth side by another kind of wall running through a segregated road with Palestinian traffic on one side, Israeli traffic on another, and a giant wall with a fence on top of it running through that. And you have about 130,000 people living today in this dense walled ghetto. And they are living in conditions of poverty. They have no sidewalks. They don't have an ATM in this enclave. The roads are in disrepair. There's not a single playground. The single main thoroughfare running from one end to the other, from the checkpoint at one end that only some of its residents are allowed to go through, to the exit on the other end. This thoroughfare that buses have to go on is too narrow for a bus and a car to pass one another at the same time. And so this walled ghetto sits right underneath the most prestigious university in Israel, the Hebrew University of Jerusalem at Mount Scopus. And from that campus, you can look down and you can see the checkpoint and the roads in disrepair and these unregulated buildings that are abutting this 26-foot tall gray concrete wall. And this is the kind of reality. It's an insane reality, but it's one that everyone is used to and hardly anyone gives it a second thought. And I too, you know, despite how much work I did among Palestinians, how much I was in the West Bank almost every day, and I would drive from my home past this walled enclave, I hardly paid attention to it myself. And it was only after this horrible tragedy befell the children and students and teachers and parents who were involved, that I really started to think about the lives of these people who share a city with me. And I sought them out and I tried to tell really the whole story of Israel-Palestine through the accident and what followed.
You mentioned a lot there, painting a visual for us. Can you elaborate on this a bit? You talked about how this area called Anata, it's 130,000 people live in this community, and you've got a 26-foot tall wall surrounding the community on three sides, and then the fourth side is a different wall that runs through a segregated road with traffic for Israelis on one side and Palestinians on the other. Can you explain how does that work exactly?
Yeah. So, you know, the road system in the West Bank is highly segregated, and it's designed basically to make it so that Israeli Jews, about 1 in 10 Israeli Jews, live in the occupied territories. And these are not your image of a settler with a caravan on a hilltop who's a religious fanatic. These are overwhelmingly bourgeois, middle class, upper middle class people who are justices on the Israeli Supreme Court, members of Knesset, ministers in the Israeli government, people who earn good salaries in high tech and commute to jobs in the greater Tel Aviv area. And the idea is to make these settlements suburbs, just ordinary Israeli suburbs that feel no different than Israeli suburbs on the other side of the Green Line, of the what is known as the Green Line, the pre-1967 boundary of Israel. And Israel has succeeded in doing that. You can travel on these highways that go from Tel Aviv, from Jerusalem to the settlements. And they're meant to give the settlers not just a very short commute, but also the illusion that they're in a continuous Jewish space from their workplace to their home. And the way to do that is to build separate road systems. And so when you pass by a Palestinian village, it has no access to the settler road. And instead, it might have an underpass, a little narrow underpass beneath a major settler highway. And Palestinians have to go some long circuitous route in order to get from A to B, unlike the settlers who are going directly to where they want to go. And so one of these roads is a road that is not only for settlers, but they built one side for Palestinians and the other side for Israelis. And this segregated road is widely known as the Apartheid Road, and it has a giant wall running through the middle of it. And again, here the idea is that the settlers who are driving on it do not have to look. The wall is blocking their view of this Palestinian ghetto on the other side of it, the town of Annata and the Shuafat refugee camp that are the main parts of this walled ghetto.
And so you spent a lot of time in Annata working on this book. So for this work, you were able to use the Palestinian road to have access to Annata?
Yes, I, as an American living in Jerusalem, can go on all of the roads. I can go on settler roads. I can go on Palestinian roads. The Israeli army is not, and the police who also operate in the West Bank, are not concerned with preventing Jews or tourists from entering Palestinian areas. Their only concern is preventing Palestinians from entering Jewish areas. So I have total freedom of movement. I can go on whichever roads I want, but a Palestinian cannot. So it would take me 10, 15 minutes, if there's no traffic, to get to Abd Salama's home, and it would take him days because he has to apply for a permit, and he's only allowed to go through specific checkpoints once he does get the permit, and those are in the wrong direction to get to my house. And so once he does get the permit, if he's granted the permit, and today it's next to impossible to do that, then it would take him, you know, 4, 5, 6 times as long to go the same distance.
We're going to take a quick break. Today, we're speaking with Nathan Thrall, whose new book just won a Pulitzer Prize, A Day in the Life of Abd Salama, Anatomy of a Jerusalem Tragedy. It tells the story of a 2012 bus accident on the outskirts of East Jerusalem in which 6 Palestinian kindergartners and a teacher burned to death. The book details how Israel's occupation has shaped every aspect of this tragedy. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, we're spending the hour with Nathan Thrall, who won a Pulitzer Prize for his new book, A Day in the Life of Abd Salama, Anatomy of a Jerusalem Tragedy. It tells the story of a 2012 bus accident on the outskirts of East Jerusalem in which 6 Palestinian kindergartners and a teacher burned to death. Nathan Thrall lives in Jerusalem. If you have any questions or comments for him about his work, what is happening in Israel and Palestine, we'd love to hear from you. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. So you've been describing what the community of Annata is like, 130,000 people surrounded by a wall. As you say, people in this community live without playgrounds, sidewalks. The roads, in many cases, are in total disrepair. There's also a shortage of classrooms and schools. And so we learn that parents in this community are forced to enter Jerusalem if they have the right ID card. They would then have to send their kids through a checkpoint and confront Israeli soldiers going to and from school, or they can send them to a private school in the unannexed part of the community.
That's exactly right. There is a chronic shortage of classrooms throughout East Jerusalem for Palestinians. There are thousands of classrooms that are needed that don't now exist. Schools are forced to operate in shifts for the Palestinians, of course, not for the Jewish students. And inside the communities like the Shuafat refugee camp and Annata, they are walled off from the rest of the city, and there are very few options for them. One of them is a poor municipal school in a former goat pen. Another option is to go through the checkpoint if they're lucky enough to have the right color ID card to be able to go to it. And then their parents are confronted with the choice of whether they want to take that risk of their kids confronting soldiers every morning and afternoon. And the other option for those who can afford it is to go to some kind of a private school. And that was the case with this particular incident where the students at the school, they all came from this enclave, and some of them were came from families with the blue Jerusalem ID card that would have enabled them to cross through the checkpoint to go to other schools on the other side of the wall, but chose instead to send their kids to this private school within the enclave that is in a part of Annata that has not been annexed by Israel. And just to give a kind of, I know this is somewhat confusing, the in 1967, Israel conquered the West Bank and East Jerusalem. It formally annexed East Jerusalem and then formally annexed the lands of over two dozen surrounding villages, one of which was Annata. And in many cases, it didn't annex the entire village because, again, the overriding principle here is that Israel wants land without Palestinians on it. So you would take the relatively empty lands of the village, but not the most densely populated area, because you want as few Palestinians as possible in the territory that Israel has annexed. And within this enclave, what you have is half of it is formally annexed and half of it is not annexed, but all of it is one different, undifferentiated area of total neglect. And in fact, you would need an expert to take you through this enclave and show you which part is considered by the State of Israel to be within the annexed sovereign area and which part is in the unannexed part, that is the West Bank. So these parents, they were entitled as taxpayers, as Jerusalem taxpayers, to receive a public education from the Jerusalem municipality. And because of the utter neglect of Palestinians in Jerusalem, they were forced to send their kids to a West Bank private school. And because this West Bank private school had children who both had the right color ID that could go through the checkpoint and the wrong color ID, the green ID that would not let them go through the checkpoint, the school had no choice but to go a very long distance to a play area on the outskirts of Ramallah, following the snaking path of this wall until they got there, and passing on the way many other play areas just a stone's throw away on the other side of the wall. And the book, you know, tells the story of this accident, but in the telling of this accident also describes the ways in which these deliberate policies led to this tragedy occurring in the specific way that it occurred.
Well, and as you point out, on that February morning, there was a terrible storm, and the kindergarten class was going to that play area, passed through a checkpoint, and then shortly thereafter, it was struck by a giant semi-trailer. And this semi-trailer was on its way to a settlement?
That's right. It was on its way to a settlement quarry northeast of Ramallah. And this, by the way, is the most blatant violation of international law. Pillage is a war crime. You are not allowed to extract natural resources from an occupied territory and to take those for the benefit of the occupier. And this is precisely what is happening in the West Bank and what was happening with this particular quarry. So the rocks are extracted from the quarry. They're taken by the semi-trailer to a factory in occupied East Jerusalem. And in that factory, then you make cement that's used to pave the roads inside Israel. The semi-trailer was on its way. It had already gone to the quarry once that morning, dropped off a load at the settlement factory in East Jerusalem, and was heading on its way back to the quarry when it struck the school bus. And the other thing that should be said is that this pillage has been approved by the internationally revered justices of the Israeli High Court of Justice. The judges in that case said that although it's clear that you are not supposed to take natural resources from an occupied territory for the benefit of the occupier, you needed to bend the rules in this particular case because it's a prolonged occupation of such length that the normal rules don't apply.
The bus flipped over, caught fire, and the children were trapped inside, and it took more than 30 minutes before the first Israeli fire truck arrived. Today, we are speaking with Nathan Thrall about his latest book, A Day in the Life of Abed Salama, Anatomy of a Jerusalem Tragedy. It just won a Pulitzer Prize. It was also named Best Book of the Year, or one of the best books of the year, by many major outlets, including The New Yorker, The Economist, and Time. We've got just about 10 minutes left with Nathan Thrall. We're going to get to calls in a minute. If you have a question or a comment about Nathan and his work, he has lived in Jerusalem for 13 years now. A number of his events have been canceled, but he is talking to people around the globe about his book and what is happening on the ground in Israel and Gaza and the West Bank. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Let's hear from John in Berkeley. Hi, John. Welcome to the show. Hi, John. Are you with us?
Jonathan.
Oh, Jonathan. Go ahead. Hi. Hello, Jonathan. Are we having phone issues? All right, let's try John or Jonathan.
Hi, are you there?
John.
Hi, John.
Yes.
Go ahead.
Yes, I'm putting you back. Nathan, thank you for your courage. Rose, thank you for your courage. And my question, Nathan, as an author, you must know this relates to a day in the life of Ivan Ivanisevich. What is it like to be spend a day in the Russian gulag? And so to bring it home, you know, a personal life. So really, it's, you know, the theme to make the person come alive. And I'm a historian, and I weep. This is horrible for Israel. And would you comment? Hello?
Thank you for the comment, John. Nathan, were you able to hear John?
I was. Thank you for those very generous and heartfelt words. Yes, of course, there is an echo in the title of the book with the famous Russian novel, One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich. And that absolutely was my aim in writing this book. I was enormously frustrated spending all these years working for an NGO, the International Crisis Group, talking to a round after round of diplomats who would come in for 3-4 year tours and be replaced by a new set of diplomats and policymakers and journalists. And all of these people would come and they would see the West Bank with their own eyes, and they would understand that these conditions were intolerable and that their governments were entirely complicit in this system of oppression. And my frustration was not in talking to these people, was not in discussing this reality with them. It was in the fact that they came to me and said, "We accept what you're saying. We understand it's awful. We understand we're responsible, but we're not going to do anything about it, because in the politics of our countries, in Europe and the United States, we would get our heads chopped off for doing the slightest thing to try and ameliorate the situation or to lessen our own government's complicity in it. And the kinds of steps that are on the table that I, as a policymaker, could take are so small that you, Nathan, would laugh at them. And so, therefore, I'm not going to risk my career to do some tiny little thing that really won't change the situation." And I had so many of these conversations that I said to myself, I am done talking to elite policymakers and politicians. What I really want to do is to talk to the broader public that is living in ignorance, unlike these policymakers and politicians, that simply doesn't know, but would be horrified if they did know. And the only way to reach that broader public was to tell a very human story, something that would read like a novel, like One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich. And through that telling, to have people empathize with Palestinians living under occupation, and I hope as a result change their view of how responsible they themselves are, and no longer feel as comfortable just dismissing Israel-Palestine and thinking of it as some distant place, but actually realizing, no, my own taxpayer dollars are going to support an entirely racist system.
What do you think, given the many years that you've spent on this issue and that you've met with so many high-level politicians, what explains that response over and over again?
The answer is very simple. It is that the politics of the pro-Israel community in the United States is very powerful and well-organized, and there is just a massive infrastructure and a massive differential in power between pro-Israel groups and groups that might want to fight for human rights in Israel-Palestine. And there's just no question, if you are looking at these two set of interest groups as a politician, there's one that has succeeded in getting people to lose elections, in ruining careers and reputations. And there's one that, you know, is very at the very beginning of starting to have some kind of effect, but up until, you know, prior to 8 months ago, could easily be dismissed.
You, in your acknowledgments, Nathan, you give thanks, of course, to your wife, And you also talk about your three daughters who have grown up in Jerusalem just over the wall that segregates them from the children in your book, A Day in the Life of Abed Salama. You write, "Although that segregation seems unlikely to end in my lifetime, I wrote the book in the hope that it can be dismantled in theirs." I mean, to think that your book came out on October 3rd, 4 days before the Hamas attacks, I mean, where do you see this going from here? And we have about 2 minutes left.
Yeah. You know, unfortunately, I have not changed the view that I expressed in those acknowledgments. I really do not see anything other than continued Israeli control of Palestinian lives for the foreseeable future. And what it's going to take to change that is radical shifts in policy, particularly by the United States, to help bring about some kind of accountability. And I do derive hope from these campus protests. I do derive hope from the outpouring of sympathy for Palestinians and the horror at what Israel is doing in Gaza. But it is a very, very long road. We still don't have the most basic things on the table, banning settlement products from American supermarkets. I mean, this is so simple. It's a no-brainer. You would think the vast majority of Americans would support that. But even that basic step isn't on the table. And so the shift in public opinion is hugely important, but we have a very long way to go before we have some chance at really changing the system.
We're getting a few emails about how hard it's been to watch what's happening in Gaza. I just want to recognize this. Eileen says, what I'm watching is abuse, which is also traumatic. I just wonder, Nathan, we're all watching this on our screens on a daily basis. You're so close to it. I just wonder what that's like. I mean, you can go to the West Bank, but you cannot go to Gaza, right?
That's right. I can't. And the sad thing is, you know, I'm an hour away from Gaza.
Wow.
And sometimes I'm much closer and can even hear the Israeli bombs going off in Gaza. Mm. And life is continuing. Life is going on. The streets are full. The cafes are full. There's Israelis going abroad for tourism again. And so you can have a very normal life in this country right now as an Israeli Jew, as this war is being prosecuted.
Mm. Well, Nathan, again, thank you for bringing this story to the world. It's really an incredible book. Thank you for joining us. Congratulations on winning the Pulitzer, and we'd love to have you back.
Thank you so much for having me. It was really a pleasure to be with you.
Thank you. Nathan Thrall is author of A Day in the Life of Abed Salama, Anatomy of a Jerusalem Tragedy. You can learn more about the book and Nathan's work at yourcallradio.org. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.